the Honorable Steve Smart, Debbie Schaefer, and Dean Smith can take their meeting outside.
Maybe we'll. I doubt it. Welcome to all of you. It's been a while. Purpose of this morning's meeting is to receive a response from the Department on the Constitution's 17th Amendment Bill. Before we actually proceed with that process, honourable members, you recall that a visit to the Magistrates Commission was mooted a week or two ago, and that is on course. It's set down for Saturday, the 17th of September, at 10 in the morning in Pretoria. Now, you would need to liaise with Mr. Romano as regards your travel arrangements. I would imagine that just about everyone will be traveling from their homes or their constituencies. And so please try and make things easier for Mr. Romano, because he has to make the necessary arrangements well in advance. As regards the Bloemfontein oversight visit, which piggybacks on Parliament's taking Parliament to the people, that's still being negotiated with the powers that be. I understand that Mr. Romano is scheduled to meet with both Mr. Frolic and some senior staff members of Parliament to get final approval of that. Mr. Jeffrey?
That would be the week of the 20th, because I had heard that there's some talk of next week.
Yeah, I think that's where the proposal from that side said, why don't we do it next week? And Mr. Romano said, no, the intention was that we piggyback on Parliament's visit to Bloemfontein. So I think, am I correct?
Well, I think what Dale Jefferson was saying is that committees that would be going to Bloemfontein should conduct oversight maybe a week or so before the actual People's Assembly in Bloemfontein. So there was a suggestion of this week and next week.
Are we looking for logistical trouble if we travel? There are very few and very small flights to Bloem, and if the entire parliament is lying up and hotel space and so forth, aren't we looking for logistical trouble if we go at that point?
I think Mr. Romano needs to bear that in mind. In fact, Parliament needs to bear that in mind. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well. Yes.
And then they couldn't land because they don't have an engine.
Okay, that must have been fun. Honourable Jeffrey?
Chair, are you going to raise the 18th Amendment?
Yeah, we'll deal with that just by way of a quick briefing to honourable members. Maybe we should do that now. Can I ask you to do that, Mr. Jeffrey?
Right, Chair. No, the I think colleagues will remember we've got the 18th Amendment, which is the FET colleges. We had a briefing. Now that was I think last term, and I think there was generally seemed to be political agreement, but the problem was the wording and unintended consequences of the way the wording was at the moment. There is a FET amendment bill in Parliament at the moment that the Minister of Higher Education had requested be prioritised so it could be passed before the start of the next academic year. That bill links itself to the constitutional 18th Amendment. But I'm not 100% sure if it's correct, because the 18th Amendment moves FETs from a concurrent competence to an exclusive national competence. The bill is then moving responsibilities of MECs to the Minister of Higher Education. But you know, so whether it is actually linked or not is something that would need to be looked at. But at the moment, the bill says it is. Now the problem is, it seems that the bill got overlooked, and there haven't been any hearings. So the committee are now advertising for public comment on the bill. They're giving effectively 2 weeks. That's until the 13th of September. I mean, it is a very simple issue, theoretically. But the idea would be, if we do have to pass it, if it does have to be passed to coincide with the FET Colleges Bill, or coming into effect when the FET Colleges Bill, we have to then pass it this term, because the NCOP needs to take time. So there is a special session on the 20th to pass sort of legislation and things. That's a Tuesday, so we'd have to aim for that. So I think the idea would be give the public till the 13th to respond, have a hearing on the 14th if there's anyone interested, and try and finalize the bill as soon as possible after that. It literally is a one-liner. I do understand from the department that they have come up with a proposed alternative wording. Because the way the section was worded, there were too many unforeseen consequences, school not being defined, early childhood development suddenly had gone off to be a national competency, which nobody wanted if that amendment went through as it was. So, Chair, that's the situation there. Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Jeffrey. Honourable members, I'm also in line with what Mr. Jeffrey had informed me of. I immediately asked Mr. Romano to have an advert sent out calling for comments and written submissions. He informs me this morning that should go out either tomorrow or the day after, with the deadline being the 13th. And the intention on our part then is to have public hearings on the 14th, and if all goes well, to approve the amendment, the Constitution, the 18th Amendment, on the 14th. Just so that you make a note of that as well.
Yeah, maybe the department could circulate. I mean, I think it was Mr. Bassett who I know we've got pillars and things in between us, but I don't think he's
here.
But maybe Mr. DeLange could take it up with Mr. Bassett to send that amendment, the redrafted, to Mr. Romano. The circulation.
Even if you call him sometime this morning, Mr. Dillon. All right, thank you. Are you ready to begin? Oh, yes. All right, before I ask Mr. DeLange to address us, consultative seminar on Millennium Development Goals. Seminar will conclude on Tuesday afternoon, the 6th of September, and no longer only on the 7th of September. 7th of September then becomes a committee day. Three committee members have been invited to attend the seminar. Chairpersons are requested to assist by identifying the members of their committees who would accompany them to the seminar, and to communicate that to their support staff, and the support staff must send the names to the projects office by 1400 hours tomorrow. It's the 6th, Monday the 5th, and Tuesday the 6th of September, that's next week. Mr. Jeffrey.
My understanding is it is not too much that relates to justice. I think it's more on gender issues specifically. And I think we are meeting on the 6th with trafficking. But I think if it's only three members, we should be able to continue. I mean, maybe it's say one or two from the majority party. I'm sure between Ms. Smuts and Ms. Schaefer. I don't know who deals with trafficking. I don't know why Ms. Smuts is looking at me like that. I don't know who deals with trafficking, but maybe the member who doesn't deal with trafficking then can go to the seminar.
Yeah, honourable members, this thing has been a long time. I'm actually glad it's going to come to a head and be out of our program, because I've really struggled to keep pace with what it's all about. And we do need to send three members. Mr. Jeffrey has made the point that perhaps, as far as we're concerned, it's mostly gender matters. And so your attendance will be on the 5th, Monday the 5th, and Tuesday the 6th. From the ANC side, it's the Honourable... Have we agreed, Mr. Jeffrey? Not quite?
I look at all of Mises arguing that he'd like, really like to attend, but I know Ms. Shoppe Sitole would like to attend.
Okay. Look, just, we're required to hand in the names by tomorrow, so maybe we should today. No, it says send the names to the project's office by 1400 on Wednesday. That's what it says, yeah. So let's leave this, your final decision, till tomorrow morning. Well, I'm not saying you must.
Predominate Ms. Shoppe Sitole.
I mean, fine.
She's keen to go. And then I think we
leave it to them to decide.
One from the DA, if they decide they don't want to, but then one would expect both DA members to be present at the trafficking meeting. and then maybe one from the smaller parties, and same between COPE and ACDK. I know Mr. Swart is very interested in trafficking.
Don't forget the IFP.
And the IFP, good idea. Maybe we should not. Let's nominate Dr. Ambrosini on behalf of the committee. Yes, he can go and talk about prostitution, yeah.
Well, all right. Alright, let's. What I'm saying is, you know, informally amongst ourselves, we can discuss so that by tomorrow morning we at least have an answer for Mr. Romano so that he can submit names before 2 p.m. tomorrow. Okay.
Yeah, sorry, I don't know, the art drafts on the magistrates' commission
report
and the Iranian extradition treaty. I think we should try and aim to finalize that in the course of this week or next week. And then we've also got, as members will probably be aware, the magistrates and judges' salary increases. But the commission has made its recommendation. The process is the president then does a draft proclamation, which he then sends to Parliament.
Okay. And
then also there's a number of other admin-y type things like
Deputy Public Protector's salary.
Public Protector's salary, and then the there's something from the Legal Aid Board. There's some guidelines for something. I mean, there's a whole range of things that maybe we can also look at fitting in next week, so that we can take them to the House the following week if possible.
Public Protector's rules. Okay. All right. I'll rely on Christine and Co to keep pace with that.
She didn't fly business class through economy like the Human Rights Commission. Maybe she did before money. Sorry.
Yeah, well. Anything else on it? No. Okay. Advocate DeLanga.
Thank you very much, Chair. We distributed a document this morning, Chair, reading is Constitution 17th Amendment Bill, Superior Courts Bill, summary of submissions and departmental response thereto. I just want to make sure that all the members have got a copy, Chair. Then I would like to thank Ms. Silkstone for the summary that she done in regard to the comments that were submitted to the committee. And what we've done is really use that summary, and we've added a row under each submission, just with the departmental response, a very brief response, Chair. And if I may start on the document itself.
Yes, sorry, I'm not sure if we've got the right. I've got a document which does say summary of submissions and department's response.
Yes.
But on the thing, I only don't have any departmental response.
Chair,
the thing below.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, okay, okay. So you usually you yeah, confused us. Documents. Well, I only got it now.
Steve.
Thank you, Chair. If I may continue.
Please.
The first issue there, or the first point, is submitted by one Mr. Paul Jewell. I hope my pronunciation is correct. And he raised the argument that the process pertaining to the introduction of the 17th Amendment Bill is flawed, since the bill, the 17th Amendment, is not a mere continuation of what was formerly called the 19th Amendment, and it should therefore have been re-gazetted for public comment in order to comply with the requirements of Section 74(5) of the Constitution. Our view is simply that the Constitution requires that particulars of proposed amendments must be published in the Gazette for public comment. And we feel that this has been done in the Gazette. It was May last year. And all the amendments that's currently proposed in this bill were published in that Gazette as required. But the short title of the bill obviously have changed, and that is mainly as a result of the fact that the Constitution, a bill, the name of a bill that amends the Constitution can only be determined once it has been passed by Parliament. And I refer then to that Section 3(2) of the Citation of Constitutional Laws Act 5 of 2005 that says that the short titles of laws amending the Constitution passed by Parliament after the commencement of the Act must reflect the chronological order in which the bills were passed. And just to pause very briefly here, Chair, I think this might be an unintended consequence of the passing of that Act in 2005. Just by way of explanation, we were faced with a very confusing situation when we approached the introduction stage of this bill into Parliament. At the time, there was a Constitution 17th Amendment bill before Parliament, not withdrawn. We were also faced with what has later become the 18th Amendment that's since been introduced, and there was a big debate between us, but what should this one be called? How do we take it to the printers? Now, fortunately, things worked out that the 17th Amendment was withdrawn formally by the minister, which meant that this one could now become the 17th Amendment. And the 18th Amendment was introduced, but from what I've learned from this, your discussion this morning already, that is now the 18th Amendment for Parliament will probably be the 17th Amendment once it has been passed. So there is some confusion. I think, fortunately, I'm not an academic, but to later do research on the history of the bills, etc., you'll have to keep your bearings very close together to follow exactly what happened. But that's just an aside, Chair. I think the bottom line is here that we feel that the proposals were all published in the Gazette. There can be no uncertainty. It's the same bill that was introduced. There was one omission. The bill that we proposed, that we published in last year, also contained an amendment which would have changed the terms of office of constitutional court judges. That has been omitted from the bill as introduced, but it does not affect the fact that those proposals in the bill currently were all in the Gazette, Chair. I don't know if I should just move on to, or maybe I should pause.
Well, if there are no comments or questions.
Some discussion. You will probably want to revisit this issue at some stage, Chair. I must concede it is an important issue. It's an important technical requirement. We feel that it has been adhered to, and We don't foresee a problem, but if the committee is uneasy, then the matter must be revisited. Chair, sorry, I'm also remiss, forgive me, I should have introduced earlier the state law advisor that assisted us and certified the bill that was closely involved in certification. He's present, it's Advocate Herman Smuts right behind me, and any questions that I cannot answer, I am sure that he will gladly be able to answer that, Chair. There's some separation of powers in this. Then the next point is also raised by Mr. Jewell, and it relates to the changing of the names of magistrates' courts to lower courts. I do not know if you would like me to read through everything that he said. They're basically saying it doesn't make sense and it's not necessary. So I want to immediately concede it's, strictly speaking, not necessary. But whether it makes sense or not is another matter. The purpose of the change is to enable the comprehensive restructuring of the magistrates' courts without having to amend the Constitution. There is no... Yeah, well, I'll get to the second line just now. But and why I said that it does make sense in one respect, it is all good and well, and we stand by what we're saying. It will make it easier for us to comprehensively reinvent the lower court, so to speak, without having to revisit the Constitution because there will be a name change of the courts. But if there's a real likelihood that we're going to change the office of magistrate to that of judge, we will need, in any event, to come back to the Constitution. There are some consequential amendments. So this is a 50-50 one. I don't think there's a problem with changing it to lower courts, but strictly speaking, we shouldn't. It's not absolutely necessary. It's a convenient thing to do at this stage.
I mean, it would just be on this point that you've got... we've got the high courts and the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Constitutional Court, and they, I think, are known, I don't know if it's constitutionally, as the superior courts. Hence we've got the Superior Courts Bill, and it might also include Labour Court and Competition Appeal Court. Now, so that's a whole group that falls under the term superior courts. Now, if you have a superior court, well, maybe you don't want to use the word inferior court, but you have then lower court. But then what are those lower courts? Are they not magistrates' courts? What are the other lower courts? Is there anything here or there on it? Why will it contribute to the restructuring of the magistracy to change the name to lower court?
I think the reason there is simply that if you come up with new legislation and you don't use the term magistrates' courts at all, then you would have to revisit the Constitution to bring that clause into line. Whereas if you go this route, that would not necessarily be required. The other lower courts presumably would be courts such as the small claims courts, if it is retained, depending on the nature and the content of the traditional courts that's going to be brought back to Parliament, that would also qualify as a lower court, depending on definition, etc. I hope that answers the question, Chair.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Would it assist in calling them lower courts in what is envisaged as the whole restructuring? In that, if we don't put it as lower courts here, we might end up having to come back to this and amend it to be lower courts. I mean, you know, if we call it lower courts here, we might be obviating something later on.
So I don't think there will be a problem if we call it lower courts here. But if we give them another name and we want it to be reflected in the Constitution, then we would have to revisit the Constitution. But that's why I raised the point earlier. That's why I say this is a 50-50 one. Because if we're going to move away from the denomination of magistrates and maybe call them judges, district judges, whatever, we would need to come back to the Constitution so as to make sure that the word judge in the Constitution does not necessarily include the judges of the lower court.
Okay, I mean, if, as you say, we're going to have a whole different array of courts that could possibly be in the lower courts, it's probably wiser then to go with lower courts now, so it incorporates all of them.
Yeah,
or potential kind.
Okay. John Jeffrey.
No, it was on that point. Yeah, it's then just simply not just the change of a name from magistrates courts to lower courts. It's lower courts is wider. So is there a need to have this reference to small claims courts? Is there a need if we are? I mean, I'm sitting next to somebody who was raising their eyebrows when there was a reference to traditional courts being included. Is the intention to include that? So, to my mind, it's not the issue of just changing the name. You could still have the magistrates' courts existing as a lower court. It's just lower court then is wider. And has the department? What are the consequences of including small claims courts reference? I mean, if we don't make this change and you just have magistrates courts, then small claims courts are not covered by the Constitution, are they?
You know, they would be. It's at clause 166, section 166 of the Constitution. You see, A, the Constitutional Court, B, the SCA, C, the High Courts, D, the Magistrates Courts, and E says any other court established or recognized in terms of an Act of Parliament, including any court of a status similar to either the High Courts or the Magistrates Courts. That's why I referred earlier to those other courts. As I said, depending on the nature of the legislation pertaining to traditional courts, they might very well require, if it's a court established in terms of an Act of Parliament, it will fall under this judicial system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do we want that? I mean, at the moment, then they're covered under what is it, the E, the sort of any other court, which then could be a court set up for a specific purpose. I mean, I'm not that comfortable with equating traditional courts to magistrates' courts. I mean, they're different. They're quite different bodies. So I think that's something maybe we should explore more the effects of that.
Chair, that's very well. Do I gather that we don't want to explore it right now?
Well, presumably you're not in a position to explore it.
but maybe what would be useful is
a list of a sort of audit of all legislation of what are these courts under, can't remember now the section, but the E section created by any other law. If municipalities want to set up traffic courts, I mean, well, those are magistrates courts, I suppose. But if transport want to set up specific traffic courts, tax courts, what are they? And maybe to get an audit of what are all these different courts, and then we can see whether they do fit into the neat definition of superior courts, lower courts, and or lower courts, and that's everything. And I do think we need to consider: do we want to lump traditional courts with magistrates' courts?
Thanks, Chair. Just to remark that it would not necessarily be similar in status to the magistrates' court, but as 166E reads at present, it says any other court established or recognized in terms of an Act of Parliament would form part of the judicial system. So that is as it is at the moment.
But if we go for this amendment and we have superior and lower, then you remove that E category. And everything then has to go into being either a superior court or a lower court.
You know, the E category is not being removed. I think if we look at the amendment, it's in clause...
If it's not being removed, what's the point unless it means that magistrates' courts are going to become lower courts, but then
Chair, also just, I mean, given the aversion magistrates have to be called magistrates, I mean, it would appear that we might well change their title, in which case it wouldn't make sense to keep these as magistrates' courts. Because then we'll have to come back and change it. That was my point.
Judges in the magistrates' courts.
All
All right, we need to think very carefully about these things.
Geshe, may I move on to the next issue then? And that is in fact the issue raised by Johasa. Refers to the single judiciary, where they say that magistrates should be referred to as judges of the lower courts, not judicial officers. And the distinction between judges and judicial officers has implication for magistrates' benefits. Do you know, I've put it there quite clearly that an earlier draft version of the bill did in fact propose changing the office of magistrate to that of judge. And that draft included a host of consequential amendments that such a change would necessitate. It emerged from the comments received on this proposal that several issues remained to be addressed before such a change could be effected. And since the main object of this bill relates to the rationalization of the superior courts, it was decided to revisit the issue of the office of magistrate and regional magistrate when the comprehensive review of the lower courts structure take place. To make it more clear, I refer to consequential amendments. What I mean there is, if the Constitution as it's written at the moment, as it's provided at the moment, has a specific meaning associated with the title judge. The JSC appoints judges, the things applicable to judges, they work until they discharge from active service, those kind of things. Now, if you change magistrates' names to judges, you would need all those consequential amendments to make this distinction. And I think it's as a result of those, probably as a result of the complexity of that earlier bill, that people realize that there are a lot of issues to be sorted out. And of course there's not consensus as to exactly how far that change should we in fact convert magistrates to being a judge for life, those kind of issues. And it needs to be sorted out before we can actually bring it to the Constitution check.
Yeah.
In the the next point was raised by the Competition Commission, and they referred to the dual appeal system that's currently reflected in the Competition Act, and it relates to the jurisdiction between the Supreme Court of Appeal and the Competition Appeal Court. Now, the amendment that's being proposed at the moment, firstly you'll see in the comments part, I said there, one, see Section 62 of the Competition Act and 167 of the Labour Relations Act, and I've added as footnotes the full provisions of those two sections, Chair. But the bottom line is simply this. The agreement was after the consultation that in respect of those two courts, an appeal should lie directly from the court to the Constitutional Court and not to the SCA. As the Competition Act, as I understand it, is worded at the moment, that is that Section 62, that is not quite going to be the case, because that section at the moment, there is some interrelation, there's some issues that can still be referred to the SCA. Our point of view is simply that that is dealt with by that department, and in that context, we're just paving the way, making it able. The Labour Relations is different. The Labour Relations Act says at the moment that the Labour Appeal Court is the final court of appeal, and any appeals from there would go to the Constitutional Court if it's a constitutional issue. But there has been judgment in the meanwhile that says that until or for as long as the Constitution provides as it does at the moment that the SCA is the final court of appeal in all matters, there is no court that can actually skip the SCA. So this would change that principle, so that you can actually go directly to the Constitutional Court. I'm sure, Chair, that the committee want to deliberate on this and revisit when we get into the actual deliberations, but I just want to make it clear what it is. Also because, if I remember correctly, one of the commentators referred to the fact that the matter is currently before NEDLAC, but that is not quite relevant for us, for our purposes. They can discuss what they want to discuss in NEDLAC, but if this is passed, then that will be the position as far as the labour issues are concerned.
Understand the advocate DeLange referred to an agreement that these courts would be, that the SCA would now be bypassed. Is that correct? I didn't quite understand what exactly. So the SCA on the present formulation will then be bypassed? Or is that, obviously that's something we've got to deliberate on.
That is correct, Chair. I may have used the term agreement too loosely. This has been discussed and consulted with specifically the head of the Competition Appeal Court, who, interestingly enough, at the stage of the drafting of the Competition Act, was part of the drafting, on the drafting panel of that Act, and he considered it was clearly an oversight on their part when they drafted that, that they did not realize that the Constitution would actually make it impossible for them to have that as a final court of appeal. And I think a very similar situation occurred with regard to Labour, to the Labour Appeal Court. But we've negotiated this over a period now from 2005 with the heads of the various institutions, which have since been substituted or replaced. There are new heads, and this has very recently, in fact, been negotiated with the heads of the Labour Appeal Court and the Competition Appeal Court, again, after consultation with all the other heads of court of the Superior Courts, Chair.
Sorry, just to follow up, their submission, in their conclusion, they say the committee, their proposes, the committee review the proposal to expand the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court to hear non-constitutional related matters, as this might add a further step in the appeals process. Now that doesn't make sense. They are in fact saying that the Constitutional Court should not hear non-constitution related matters. So we need to just look at this whole issue, because it's a matter of principle with specialist courts. First of all, that we need to deliberate, and then I'd be interested to know just as a how many decisions of the SEA has overruled the Constitutional Appeals Court. That would be quite interesting to know as well. Is that, are we able to get that information?
I'm sure we can get that information. I know of one instance, but they might by at this time they might be more chill.
But you understand there's a principle issue here, a general principle issue, but it would be interesting to know what the role the SEA has played up to now. It could be very interesting. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Jean Smith.
That was the same thing. You see, and I ask myself, to what degree should I allow myself to be influenced at all by people who say to me, oh, but you realize that so-and-so has been reversed in the SCA. And the number of times, I don't know. But I'm asking myself, should I allow myself to be influenced by that? Because surely the argument should be free of such considerations. Because the imputation is quite clearly that Judge Davis doesn't like to be reversed, and therefore he's now, you see, I mean, it's a fairly shocking suggestion, but I agree with Steve, it would be interesting to know, yes, but I'm sure that we should decide the matter on other, cleaner grounds.
Chair, maybe just a final word on that, final remark on that. When we discussed this issue specifically with regard to the Competition Appeal Court, the recurring theme was how time is of the essence in those kind of matters, and the, how the whole purpose of that act is to make sure that, and I think the representative used the example of, it's no use sitting about nationwide, and when the case is finally decided, nationwide ceases to exist, and that is their problem. They don't want that additional level.
The Honourable Sheila Shoppers-Toilet.
Oh, thank you, Chair. I just want to say that Advocate Delange is correct not to worry about what a commentator has said. You know, where I come from, you know, rural women don't worry about commentators because they consider them as people who are free to say whatever they like. And in most cases, they have been proved to be just out of touch with reality, especially with the World Cup thing, you know. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair. I just want there to be no confusion. I'm not disregarding what anybody is saying, but it did remind me of one of the Latin maxims, which I thought is particularly, or sometimes should play a bigger role in modern society, which says that, I think, and forgive my pronunciation, vanae vocis populi non sunt audienda. It means you do not listen to the idle chatter of the proletariat, of the people.
What about what spoken was saying?
Well, yeah.
when I read some of the comments, of the earlier comments, I thought that thought did cross my mind.
Advocate Holomis.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. It could be that I want to be clarified on as in clarified, but I'm still a little bit confused. The comment by the Competition Commission is to the effect that they support the elimination of SCA from the system. Does that mean the bill is eliminating the involvement of the SCA so that whatever would have been done by the SCA would be handled by the CAC, and that therefore any other matters maybe relating to the Constitution would then go directly to the CAC without any need at all for the SCA, rather to the CC instead of going to the SCA, so that the SCA does not play a role at all in such matters?
Yes, that is correct. It will go directly from the Competition Appeal Court to the Constitutional Court. But I must add that not as the Competition Act is at the moment. There are still some areas where they do refer to the SCA. But that would be for that part of the legislature to amend that act if they want to change that. What we are doing here is enabling an act of Parliament to say that the SCA would not necessarily have the final, be the final court of appeal in all matters. It would be possible in this instance the Competition Act would then be able to allow for matters to go directly to the Constitutional Court, and the Labour Relations Act already allows for the Labour Relations Appeal Court to be the final court of appeals and not go to the SCA unless of course it's a constitutional matter.
Lastly, Chair, what is the view of the SCA in this particular matter?
I must admit that I do not have a formal input from them on this issue, but I'm sure that we can invite them to give us a further comment. We do have comprehensive comments that were submitted to the Minister during the course of last year, but they did not have a specific input on this issue. But also I must add that at the time we did not have this provision. So this is new, but they've not responded to it.
The Honourable Schaefer, followed by the Honourable Stiss, what happened?
Mr. De Lange just told us at the beginning that there was nothing new when it was advertised, now he's saying it is new.
Yes, Mr. De Lange.
I'm just kind of... Yes, in fact, that is a technical change that was made. Previously, we did say that the Supreme Court of Appeal may decide appeals in any matter arising from the High Court or a court of a similar status to the High Court. So this is really. I see JB has now arrived. He can maybe help me with the time frame in this regard. But it was rather recently, I think towards the end of last year.
So, Chair, the question then is that first point relevant? Should it not have been re-advertised? Is that...
It's a proposed amendment that was proposed to the Constitution, and the proposed changes to that section was advertised. I don't think it's necessary. We're still dealing with the same, with a redraft of the same section. I wouldn't go as far as to think that that would be necessary.
The issue of comments from the SCA is still hanging there, and we need to think about
it. We need to get that, yes.
Yes. Mr. Scosano, would you wish to comment on this particular issue?
Thanks, Chair. During the October meeting of the heads of courts with the minister, the SCA were supportive of this amendment that would exclude that jurisdiction, that the matter should go straight to the SCA. I'm not sure that's still their position, because they did call me last week and they wanted to make further submissions, but I've not seen them. I don't know whether in the submission they've made to Bonan they've covered it as well. But in October they did agree with it.
Can I hear Mr. Swart first, Honourable Chair?
Yeah, I appreciate the input, and maybe we can get that input that was referred to, that was in October, in writing as to the role of the SCA. But it's complex, we need to look at that. So I think I'm understanding their written submission is not exactly in line with what we are debating, and I think we just need, because that sentence that I read earlier, to that end, the proposal is that the committee review the proposal to expand the jurisdiction of the Constitutional Court to hear non-constitution related matters. So in other words, they are opposed to the CAC hearing non-constitutional matters on appeal, as well as in favour of removing the SCA. So there's, but we can deliberate on that. I'd like to hear those cases, and I'd like to hear what the SCA says now on the issue. That would be useful, because the role of the SCA at the moment is very narrowly. It's a very narrowly defined role, and it was in the legislature, and the submission is that there's an unintended consequence from the legislature side at that stage. So we can look at all those issues as a matter of principle. Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Schaefer, followed by Advocate Holamy, sir.
No, just if we can just firm up that we are going to, in fact, ask for those comments as soon as possible from the ACA as to what their views are, so we can have it formally. Thanks.
Advocate Holamy, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Just one more priority from the two gentlemen. Currently, as the legislation stands relating to the CAC and the SCA, are they not of the same level? Or were you saying that there are certain aspects that may be dealt with by the CAC which could be appealed to the SCA? It should mean then that the SCA is slightly higher than the CAC?
I think that would be correct, Chair. At the moment, the SCA is higher in rank because you can still appeal from the one court to the SCA.
All right. Next. So, honourable members, can we then agree that we invite comments from the SCA on this draft? Okay.
Perhaps the CC as well.
And the CC? Okay. Mr. Romano is just bringing to my attention that the heads of courts are scheduled to make a submission on this bill. Now, well, I'm not sure how they're doing that, as a collective or...
So, Chair, I think that was by the SCA that in the absence of the Chief Justice, that was delegated to just judge and party.
Yeah. Well, my understanding was that deliberations on this matter, as they relate to the heads of court, would be done by a justice and party. I'm not sure whether that constitutes a comment from the SCA per se. Yes, yes, there's a difference, isn't there? Yeah. All right. Have you got all of this?
Chairperson, if then there is still that kind of comprehensive submission that will be done, is it this SCA or the heads of courts?
Heads of courts.
Heads of courts, that would mean, have they been given the submissions that are already before us? In which event they would be expected to comment on them as well?
No.
I'm just asking. Because they would, if they are going to have to submit, to make submissions, I suspect that they are likely to address all the clauses in the bill, which would mean then that we would have to also, when you look at their views, we'll also be looking at the views of the other people who have made submissions. Just a thought.
All right. I suppose it can't do any harm if we ask for the submissions we've received to be referred to the heads of courts. And if they feel they need to consider them as part of the submission to us, then so be it. All right?
Provided it's in their judgment. I mean, they need not.
No,
it's not procedurally quite proper, is it?
No.
But if they wish to.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Just on a side, on a slight issue of, lest I be accused of misrepresentation, I just want to state very upfront that I'm not an advocate, so it's not necessary to. I've never sinned in that regard. I've done nothing to deserve that. Chair, the next point has been raised by Advocate Frans Reinecke. It relates to Section 176 of the Constitution and relates to the terms of office of the Constitutional Court judges. There we're simply stating that this is definitely a case where the bill isn't amending Section 176, and we have a view that if we wanted to effect a change there, you would need to go through the whole process of publishing in the Gazette that this change is on the cards. Interestingly enough, I referred to it earlier, the bill that we published in May last year had an amendment that was proposed at that stage. Was that they would not have a fixed term, that they would be judges until discharged from active service, the same as other judges. I don't think it's necessary to go into the detail now, but we've received a host of comments on that. People were very divided on this issue, and in the end it was decided that there's not sufficient merit at this stage to go along with that amendment, but that is not to say that sometime in future one might want to revisit this issue, but at this point in time, it's not on. On that as well, this is just a remark. There's also the bill presently before the committee, before Parliament, on the Judges' Remuneration Conditions of Employment Amendment Bill. I'm sure that the committee would want to apply themselves at some stage as to how that matter would be taken forward. But ideally, the bill does afford a vehicle to address the judgment of the Constitutional Court, so at least we've got that benefit. There is a problem that's been found a problem with, and we can just use the bill, but that's for another day.
Mr. Ambrosini.
Clarity on this point. I thought that the judgment of the Constitutional Court made that bill unconstitutional. I mean, if we change it, we would need to substantially to make it constitutional. We will need to re-advertise, which at that point one can have a new bill.
Chair, now the point is simply this. The judgment of the Constitutional Court says Section 8 of the Act is unconstitutional. How you address that is you introduce an Act and you amend Section 8. All I'm saying is we've already got a bill. We can just use that bill to bring it into line with the Constitution.
As I understand the judgment of the Constitutional Court that says either you do it for everyone or you don't do it for anyone. You need to treat all the judges on the Constitutional Court in the same way, which the bill doesn't do. So if it does it, if we change the bill to make it do it, we would need to deal with a complete new bill with a new content which would need to be re-advertised.
I don't know if you want to go into the detail right now, but all we need to do, and that's purely my point of view, it's not on behalf of the department. You've got a two-clause bill. So you drop the one clause dealing with the extension of office, drop it, and you just adopt the other clause where we're presently amending Section 8, we just say we repeal it, and that's it. The whole problem is solved.
All right, we'll look at that.
Thanks, Jay. Then the next issue would be the legal the LSSA, the Law Society of South Africa. They're raising the point that they do not support the establishment of the Constitutional Court as the apex court, and they oppose the amendment of Section 167. The CCR, if I can just skip to them directly, that is the Center for Constitutional Rights. They are concerned about the implications, the increased workload, time-consuming perpetuation of distinction, etc., etc., and the current composition and modus operandi of the Constitutional Court not conducive to be an apex court. And they recommend that if the CC is established as the apex court, we should review the composition appointment criteria of the judges and the way it sits, and may require further amendments. The Legal Resources Center, on the other hand, supports that, and I will return to them later. And on the next page, the Democratic Governance and Rights Unit of UCT also opposed this. They've got a rather more substantive submission where they say that the CC is an, turning the CC into an apex court would be harmful to the constitutional jurisprudence, the constitutional jurisprudence of that court, and clause 3 should not be passed. Chair, now this is really, I suppose, a matter where the department has a very limited role to play. It is really a policy matter, but we just want to reiterate that the provisions of this clause seek to give effect to what is de facto the current legal position. That the Constitution is the supreme law of the Republic, and the Constitutional Court has the ultimate jurisdiction to adjudicate on the constitutionality of all laws, including the common law, which is in fact, or after all, derived from the Constitution. If you read Section 6, Schedule 6 of the Constitution, all law in this country is derived from the Constitution. And I need not refer to, there are examples when there were questions as to whether the Constitutional Court has jurisdiction. We really go to some lengths to eventually find that you've got jurisdiction. I think that maybe the time has passed for that kind of artificial distinctions to be made. And there are some safeguards, the leave of the Constitutional Court that would have to be sought to appeal to the court in any matter falling outside its present jurisdiction, which would ensure that only matters where the interests of justice so require are heard by the apex court. Then, we've added in our comments in our response to the consent of the constitutional rights that, and I say this very with great circumspection, that it may arguably be appropriate to provide for some kind of transitional arrangement when you put this provision into operation, such as, for example, determining a date from which the amendment of Section 167 would take effect, which date could be some years in future, depending on what you decide in the end. But I think that once this decision has been taken to go that route, then one can address the issue as to how exactly do you achieve that, make sure that the bench is aligned, that everything else that need to be aligned is aligned.
Okay.
First, Mr. Ambrosini, followed by the Honourable Schaefer, and then the
Honourable Steve Swart. Mr. Chairman, allow me to express my disquiet with the statement that the bill would merely legalize the status quo. And I think that that is a departmental response I cannot use an expression other than say I think it's not true. It's a statement made to us which is not true. I do accept that the Constitutional Court decided its own jurisdiction. I do accept that in so doing the Constitutional Court has pushed those limits beyond where some people thought those limits were, and has redefined those limits. But in a situation in which we eliminate those limits and giving what is a potentially unlimited and unqualified jurisdiction on any matter, it's only subject to the power to choose and pick the certiorari, that is a complete, complete different situation from what is the status quo, the factual situation. So I think that I'm very taken aback by the department making such statement obviously untrue.
Mr. Chair, I just want to understand the department's views then as to what the role of the SCA would be, because to me it looks like it's irrelevant if we accept the Constitutional Court as the apex court, and what happens to the SCA?
Now, Chair, I wanted to just also add to what Dr. Ambrosini said very clearly, the LSSA's view is that they do not support the establishment of the CC as the apex court in respect of matters on merit only. There's a very important qualification there. And in their submission they say, in respect of matters of merit not related to constitutional issues. So there's a vast difference between the situation that is envisaged and the situation at the moment, where the court looks at constitutional matters and not other matters on merit which are not related to constitutional matters. And that is an issue we're going to have to deliberate on. What then is the role of the SCA and what then is the role of the Constitutional Court? But I don't think that we are going to just establish what is the de facto situation at the moment. I think it is broadening it. It all obviously comes down to what the meaning is of the terms interests of justice and how we're going to interpret that. Should we put that as the gatekeeper? You remember I raised the questions with Professor Tallant. What do we mean? What meaning must be given to those words? Because that will determine which cases go to the Constitutional Court. And I think we will deliberate on that, and it's going to be an issue of policy, quite correctly, as to which way we decide to go. And if we do decide to go the route recommended, the transitional provisions that may be necessary, what is the role of the SCA? And is there any danger of the Constitutional Court? I think it came up in the public hearings, cherry-picking cases in the interest of justice. And I think those are some of the issues we're going to have to deliberate on. We fully support that they are the apex court for constitutional matters, but whether it's to be extended totally, I think there's a lot that we need to deliberate on. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Mr. Villanga. Well, either you or Mr. Scassone, if you wish to respond.
Let me start with the position of the SCA and the CC. This is one point where the two causes come together at all. I've forwarded to Mr. Jeffrey the comprehensive submission they made on this particular issue. And the SCA... Hello? I'm saying I've shared with Mr. Jeffrey. But
why not with the committee?
No.
Put yourself in trouble now. I can't get you out of it, unfortunately. Much as I'd like to.
Okay. No, I will.
It's on its way to us.
Yes.
All right.
No.
We have to follow it.
I've indicated that we have some views that we received from them and which we'd like to share with the committee. And so I'm right when I'm saying I want to wait here too, because basically they could even assist in the future submission that can happen. The SCA has always maintained a position that the status quo in terms of their own arrangement, being the appeal court, should stay, and that only exceptional matters should end up at the CC. In fact, when they both met, they suggested that the name should be swapped around. They suggested that if these amendments should be processed, it will mean then the Constitutional Court becomes the Supreme Court of Appeal. It becomes the Supreme Court. And then they become a Court of Appeal. And then it can then say then come with a caveat which can then decide which appeals can go beyond the SCA. And we say fundamental policy shift, etc., in terms of the arrangement. But that's what they have said in their own view. And as I've said, there have never been any agreement between the two courts. And basically, in view of the skills, based and competence that exists between the two courts, understandably so, and the appointment mechanisms, arrangement that Mr. Dillon have raised over the past. The Constitutional Court currently in terms of Constitution is an apex court in terms of constitutional matters. So I don't think that we may need to change the arrangement any other different, because it's the highest court in constitutional matters and has the jurisdiction to decide whether a matter is a constitutional court or not, etc. Obviously, the position that Mr. Langer referred to of the current de facto status is that power given to your court to take matters on the basis of national interest, etc., because it goes across and it got an inherent power currently, which makes it an apex court can take, it can hear any matter that which the SCA views that it should end with them. So they can take any other matter. Now the question is whether from a perspective is it important to curtail that right or to leave it open, and whether even if by legislation you leave it open, will it be sufficient in law to prescribe what constitutes national interest when they basically determine that aspect from time to time when they are seized with the matters themselves. So it will create a very interesting discourse between the two concepts.
Advocate Holomisa, followed by the Honourable Dean Smuts.
Mm-hmm. In my simple understanding of these issues, all laws and decisions of courts and others have to comply with the Constitution. That is why, therefore, the Constitutional Court is higher than the Supreme Court of Appeal. Hence, even the head of that court is the Chief Justice of South Africa. Now, I do not know where the discomfort is with the current situation, the status quo, because the SCA indeed deals with all and any and all matters, including constitution-related matters. But that then anyone feeling aggrieved can appeal to the Constitutional Court when they believe that the Constitution has been violated. So what is the need of all these things to establish what is the apex court and what is where they should be, what is the court again, the other one? No, the
Court of Appeal.
No, there's this thing called what is it that we're dealing with in our committee? Whether the structure of the court must have two humps or
different
apex, yeah, twin peak and apex. I think if you can just be enlightened, say, what is the need for this kind of debate at all?
Mm-hmm.
If I'm correct in my interpretation of how these two courts are supposed to operate. Where is the source of unhappiness? And,
Honourable Dean Smuts, followed by Mr. Ambrosini.
The discomfort is in the fact that everything is constitutional, as Mr. Langer correctly pointed out. There are not different rules of law in South Africa. Everything is, everything sits under the Constitution. And the reason why people have become uncomfortable with the idea of a separate constitutional court, and Carol Lewis still said it best, is because of the artificiality to which Mr. Nenonga also referred. The constitutional court is supposed to take matters which are constitutional, but because everything is constitutional, this decision making has become increasingly artificial, and they strain sometimes to find the constitutional dimension, presumably when they want to take a case, but everything is constitutional. And on then-Professor, now-Judge Lewis's analysis, having the separate twin peak courts impedes the coherent development of the law. It just, if everything is constitutional, what are you doing with two separate twin peak courts? And this is an old and established argument by now, and it lies behind the idea that there should be only one apex court. Now, I mean, I ask myself now increasingly, I mean, as things stand, the Constitutional Court takes something purportedly when it's constitutional. Everything's constitutional. So if you turn them into an apex court, that deciding factor, which is currently phrased as the interests of justice, which satisfies most people, but what is really meant is a matter of public importance, isn't it? And so maybe one should say that. But you don't share what... I increasingly ask myself, you know, the one big problem with turning the Crown Court into an apex court is that it does not have the range of skills. We're all familiar with the argument. It doesn't have the range of skills. There's this very specific kind of person has been appointed to it, because the real reason why it was invented was to have a nice, fresh, new court under the Constitution with appointees representing the country demographically. That was the real reason it was created, rather than a pure choice for a Western European socio-political court. So now, I ask myself, which court does have the range of skills? Supreme Court of Appeal has the range of skills. If you want an apex court, they set the range of skills. And, I mean, I think one must do a bit of lateral thinking here, because we're running into all sorts of trouble. But maybe that's your apex court. And on the matter of the composition of the Grand Court, I still don't understand why the JSC, knowing full well that these proposals were coming, didn't interview and appoint people with the full range of skills for an apex court in mind at the last round. The last four appointees, they were interviewed just like any other Grand Court judge in the past. So it has been my proposal that if you want to do this thing, if you want to turn the Crown Court into the apex court, then it would have to be phased in. How else do you do it? You will have to wait until you have the full range of legal skills sitting on the Crown Court. And as Mr. Langer says, one, maybe the only way to do it is to set a date. And that date will have to be quite, quite far away, in fact, a decade or two, before you say, yes, when do they all expire? You know, how else are you going to do? And we had, when Richard Kelland appeared before us with the DTRU, he said that Hugh Corder had volunteered, not Richard Kelland's outfit, but Hugh Corder had volunteered to do some thinking on a phasing in a provision. Because I don't see how else can you do it? They are not, as they sit there, qualified to be the apex court on all matters. And if you take the view that everything is constitutional anyway, then I say to you, I mean, the full range of skills sits in the other place. It sits in Bloemfontein, and maybe we should be thinking laterally.
Well, assuming that I agree with you that the full range of skills sits in Bloemfontein, I suppose that could be debated. But will the full range of skills ever sit in the Constitutional Court? I mean, that's another matter. I mean, you know, I don't think we'll ever have that full range of skills, because the intention... Yeah, because when one has to leave because his term has expired, he takes with him or her that range of skills. And you're never going to, even with the JSC's processes, you're never going to replace that person. Like as like, replacing like with like, as it were. You know, so it's like a football team. Cesc Fabregas leaves Arsenal, and the supporters demand that an exact replacement be found and be placed in the team. And you say, but it's not possible. It's never going to happen. Same here. I simply raise that as a question.
I mean, out of turn, just to... You know, the example they all like to use out there is maritime law. Yeah. How can the Constitutional Court be an apex court? They don't know what a bill of lading is. So when we say the full range of skills, we mean the commercial and the maritime and the civil and the blah blah. All the stuff that the SCA can do and does do, and those appointees are made with an eye to the lacunae. I mean, one certain judge I understood was appointed to the SCA, and thank God for understanding banking. I mean, they are highly sophisticated fields of law that need to be looked after.
The Honourable Ambrosini.
The Chairman, I think it's important to have clarity. has been said to us and proceed from that basis. I have not heard anyone telling to us that everything is constitutional. I know of no competent lawyer, constitutionalist, who would support the statement that everything is constitutional. That statement is a wrong statement. The statement which has been made, which is profoundly different, and we need to understand it for what it means, is that everything can be, every aspect of law can have a constitutional relevance. And there can be something anywhere which can be in point of constitutionality. Any aspect of law, including the maritime law, could have an equality clause issue arising under it, could have a legality issue in terms of exercise of public function under the law. But those aspects, no matter how one wishes to stretches them, as compared to the vastitude of legal questions arising out of the law, remain a very small portion of the judicial activity, of the hermeneutic activity, of the interpretative activity, of the applicational activity. So this is the starting point.